Radio, everybody, and now I get to say this finally live from New York. It's Rebooting the News with me and Jay Rosen.
Live from New York University.
Oh, that's true. Well, you know, they don't say that on Saturday Night Live. They don't say live from New York University.
We should explain that we're sitting in a radio studio, and I'm in one room, and Dave's in the other, and we can see each other through the glass, so it's kind of
pretty
cool.
Funny. Yeah. And we're also recording this, so there'll be a beautiful high-fidelity recording, you know, knock wood, praise Murphy, et cetera, et cetera. And in the meantime, we also have it set up so that our live listeners are cued in. So, you know, this is jury-rigged, but it should get better, right?
It should get better. Yeah. We kind of sort of know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Let's get right to some of our subjects.
Sure.
If you don't mind, Dave, I'd love to start off with what Google called social search and what you called two-way search. So that's
right.
Something that that also interests me. You wrote a post about it this week at Scripting News. So would you mind summarizing what two-way search is and what Google said it was going to do this week?
Right. Okay. Well, it's not just what they said they're going to do. They've actually done it. And it was a notable announcement because basically there was no fanfare whatsoever. It just happened. And there was a blog post about it, but it didn't get picked up by any of the tech sites. Just sort of went unnoticed largely. But you could see it in your search results. So if I searched for a movie, I forget what I was looking for. It'll come back to me. But if I was searching for a movie and it would show me in the list of search results that Cody Brown had also written something about the movie. And this was a result that normally would not have shown up in the search results, but it put it there because they knew, they knew that that Cody was in my social circle, it had gotten the information from Twitter that I followed Cody and Cody follows me, and Cody had written something about the movie that I was asking about, and it figured I would probably find that more relevant than most people would, so it showed it to me. And it also explained to me how it got it. And I thought, well, this is a pretty good look at the future. This is what Twitter can't do. You know, everybody says, well, Twitter is great for real-time stuff. Well, now they've found a way to integrate the real-time with the normal, you know, dominant Google search. It's just hugely high value. I mean, there so many times you're looking up something and you wonder, why did they choose that interpretation of this word? If they just looked at my blog, they would know that, that I'm a software guy. I like to write about RSS. I'm into skiing. I'm living in New York now, et cetera, et cetera. So why not show me the results that are relevant? So like if I type in the garden, you know, into a Google search, maybe it would put Madison Square Garden first because
I get it.
You see what I'm saying? It's like, but somebody typing in the garden in London might get something completely different because why would they care, you know? If I type in dry cleaners, they should show me something in the West Village that's for dry cleaning, not something that's in, maybe not even something that's in Berkeley because it knows right now that I'm in the West Village, you know?
Right. So it's both possibly geolocation, but also social location.
Right.
As well as membership in a community that would begin to shape your search results.
Should be everything about you, really, that shapes the search results. Why not? I mean, it's always struck me as, you know, if you asked your assistant, you know, a question, they would incorporate everything that they know about you into the answer to that question.
Right.
Why shouldn't your assistant online also do the same thing?
Right. So what might this mean for a rebooted system of news, besides just improving search?
Well, you tell me. come on, Jay.
I think it has implications for local news, especially if you're, because it's very hard to find information about particular places. That's one of the things that the web hasn't been all that good at. And if we have more local producers, then one of the problems that arises as we gain more producers is how we're going to find what they produce. So anything that helps refine search and narrow it down to a place, whether it's a social geography or real location, helps the producers of news from a particular place be found.
Maybe news is becoming search and search is becoming news. I mean, maybe news is just a query, you know, for a search engine, you know, what's happening right now, you know? Ultimately, maybe that's all. Maybe Google is taking, a huge step towards doing that with this, you know, with this change to two-way, you know. It's going to be refined over time, but the big jump was the decision that who you are, you know, the context of your search is relevant. And there's no reason why time isn't part of that as well. I'm sure it already is.
Why do you use the phrase two-way?
Why do I use the phrase
two-way?
What's
two-way about it?
Because in a sense, you're programming, you know, the search as much as the people. I mean, the web is the surface that the search takes place on. So if everybody does the search, the same search, and gets the same result, that seems to me to be one way. Mm-hmm. But if I am now programming that search by every action that I do, then I am controlling it, or I'm providing it information as much as it's providing me with information.
Right.
And so it's, you know, it's a fundamental difference. It's like the word audience. I don't like the word audience that much, because I don't think it reflects what's actually happening in our world these days. There's got to be a better way of thinking about it. And this is a good example of that. I mean, you know, the more you blog, the better search works for you is the idea. Why they don't, I mean, yet, I don't think they index. I mean, if I wrote an article entitled, you know, "The Mets Are Great" or something like that, right? And I go search for "The Mets Are Great." Seems to me that my article ought to be the first hit, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's got all the context. I wrote an article with that exact title, you know. And if I'm searching for a title with a piece with that title, it seems to me it knows what I'm looking for pretty much.
Well, another reason it could be important for a rebooted system of news is that in the past, we looked for content in part by containers that it was in. And what the web has done is busted up that arrangement so that individual articles, or as we call them in blogging, posts, can be found regardless of whether you know about the container they came in, the publication they ran in, the site they originally appeared at. And so what search does is it busts up the power of delivery monopolies to make individual contributions searchable and findable. Mm-hmm. And what it also should do is make it possible to find containers or sites that you don't know exist yet, because maybe they're new, or they popped up overnight, or they arose in response to events, you know, like when people put a new site online because New Orleans just got flooded, or some event occurred that caused them to start a new site. So anything that allows new sites, small sites, and individual posts to be found, regardless of where they appeared, is part of the logic of the new system of news. And that's what I see as one of the implications of two-way search.
But authority counts a lot too, right? I mean, are we substituting for our, you know, Washington Post and Time Magazine and Business Week, are we substituting Google for those names? I mean, are we assuming that because Google gave us this result that they were right in giving us this result?
I mean, well, we still need authority, yeah.
Right, which sort of suggests to me that the big names in the authority business ought to be more actively involved in trying to create this sort of search system of the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're sort of sitting on the sidelines, sort of hoping that everything works out. We need them in that, you know, this has been a constant theme on this show, is that, you know, while I love, and I think I could speak for both of us, that we love the technology, you know. It's excited by the promise of it. You know, it's still important to have that human authority sitting in there somewhere.
Yeah, it just can't be a static or frozen system of authority. It has to be supple.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm with you, though. I want there to be a lower barrier to entry. If somebody has something really brilliant and important to say about something that isn't, you know, hasn't been approved through all the, you know, channels of authority, I definitely want to hear about it.
Yeah, and why shouldn't we have short-term magazines, if you know what I mean? We should be able to create sites that arise in response to events and live for a certain period of time, go out of existence, but show up in search. If we can do that, then we can have readers and writers come together improvisationally around events and then dissipate when those events are over. And it makes it much more of a fluid and flexible system if we don't have to rely on these rigid containers, although they still have some value as well.
No, I love that. I mean, I think we need more of – it's sort of like the way – the entertainment industry does projects. You know, they have a movie. It might take 5 years to produce the movie, but after it's all done, they all go their separate ways. Some of them may work together again, but they may never work together again. You don't have this idea, of a production. You do have ensembles. I mean, I was listening to an interview with Jeff Bridges, who was talking about actors that he likes to work with, or the Coen brothers tend to pick the same actors, you know, because they learn how they work and stuff. But it's always reconfigured. It's always room for somebody new to come in, and nobody has a sense that they have a permanence. And I think it's more realistic. It's a better way for us to work. It may be more reflecting how the job market actually works these days.
Yeah, that's right. So, and it's a shift from publication with its sort of masthead in stone to project, which comes together, meets a need, and then resolves itself, right? And then comes together for a new project. So just as Post is a unit of production in the rebooted system of news, the project may be the container rather than the channel, the magazine, the program, the show.
Right, but there's still elements that really gain from permanence. Infrastructure.
That's true too. Yeah,
infrastructure is one of them. I mean, you know, we're sitting here in this really nice studio. There's no need for us to recreate this studio every week, right? It's kind of a nice. I hope it'll become a nice thing to know that this is always here.
Yeah, if we ever institutions want to do a matter. Podcast, right? So does infrastructure. Yeah.
Right. Right.
And also, institutions matter for another reason, which is their stored trust.
Yeah.
You know, that's what reputation is. That's
in a way, that stored trust actually, it betrays its own storage, you know, and that the more esteemed a publication gets, the harder it is, the more inflexible it becomes, and then the less responsive it becomes to change. And in news, that's exactly where you don't want lack of response, you know, because news is inherently about what's new. And if a news structure has trouble adapting to newness, it's probably time for a new news structure.
Well, the problem with established, trusted, reputational brands in news is the same problem as permanent political reporters in Washington. They eventually realize there's a conflict between telling us what's going on right now and being critical of the players and what they need to survive long term as a reporter in the Capitol and the relationships they need to maintain over time, administration to administration. So there's a tension between immediate needs of serving the audience and the long term survivability of the individual reporter. And what happens in news is the same thing, is they create an investment in protecting their reputation that sometimes comes into conflict with telling us the hard truth right now. Although I think most people in professional news organizations tend to overlook this conflict or mute it or may not even be aware of it at all.
Well, it happens in the technology business periodically. It's almost predictable. The news people in the technology business do exactly this. They get deeply in bed with the people that they're covering, maybe intentionally, maybe not. Maybe they're not even aware to the extent that they are. And to the point where what seems to an outsider a pretty outrageous situation develops, but it's hardly covered at all by the news people, but travels by word of mouth. A good example was the thing about Apple not allowing location-based advertising in iPhone apps, which crossed your radar on Monday, crossed mine on Friday a couple of days earlier, but didn't really raise very much of an alarm in the tech blogosphere, because the tech industry, this has become such the norm that the developers are in this box, and the box just gets taller and taller unless light gets inside of the box. And these people, I guess, don't study history, because this has happened many, many times before. And when it does, it's usually deleted in a very explosive way. The walls build up and they build up and they build up, and finally they just get knocked out. And that happened, the last really big time that happened was around 1994, when the web just swept aside the entire personal computer software industry. Just really overnight, almost, went from, there was this whole assumption that this is the way things always work and always will work, to that doesn't matter anymore, and we're off in this new space, and all of a sudden developers have every freedom they could ever imagine. It was thrilling, and so much so that the government started passing laws that basically, invalidated the First Amendment on the internet. They were so scared by what was happening, and that eventually became the norm and settled in, and it's time again for that.
Let me discuss a related example of this phenomena that I wrote about this week. This little story that began to interest me. I don't pretend that it's a large matter. It's actually a very small matter. But sometimes as a blogger, I like to take things that are small and significant and just continually look at them and press on them until they kind of pop open and reveal a bigger situation. And this happened to me with this story that ran in April of 2009 in TheWrap.com, which is a online news site that covers Hollywood and the entertainment industry. And it was started by Sharon Waxman, who's a former entertainment industry reporter for both the New York Times and the Washington Post. And she did what a lot of professional journalists are doing, which I actually admire. She took the buyout and she went out on her own, and she created her own site that competes both with the trade press, like Variety and, Inside Hollywood Press, and sort of the bigger news organizations like the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times for Inside Hollywood News. Mm-hmm. And she's learning a lot of lessons about the web and self-sufficiency and entrepreneurship, which as a reporter on a staff of 1,000, she never even had to think about, right? So that's all to the good. In April of 2009, she ran this item at The Wrap that said that Frank Luntz, the Republican political consultant who you sometimes see on Fox News and who is behind a lot of the Just Say No behavior of the Republican coalition, because he researches where the voters are and he recommends strategies for the party. And this item said that Frank Luntz was quitting politics and giving up the whole political game because he wanted to become the entertainment industry's researcher, and he wanted to break into that business, and he was so determined to do so that he was giving up his political business. And I remember running this item in my Twitter feed. It kind of surprised me because Frank Luntz was born to be a politico. It's in his blood. You can just feel his enthusiasm for the craft of electoral politics when you watch him on television. Nonetheless, it said he was giving it up and he was moving out to Hollywood and had bought a house in Santa Monica, and he was tired of selling reality. He said, he told Sharon Waxman, politics is a dirty business and I'd rather sell fantasy.
Did you say
things,
selling reality?
Yeah, that's what he said. That's what he said. So, yeah.
Well, that was kind of a joke, huh?
That, well, okay. So a month later, Dave, I find Frank Luntz's name on a one of these consultants' reports sent to the Republicans about how to beat Obama back on health care. And then a few months after that, his name pops up again as a consultant to a candidate in Colorado in a United States Senate race. And then just last week, Frank Luntz is advising the congressional Republicans again on what to say about financial reform, because that's coming into discussion now in Congress. And so he's obviously doing exactly what he's always done. And Sharon Waxman's April 2009 item was completely wrong. He didn't abandon politics for Hollywood at all. So, in my view, when you're completely wrong about something, you should correct it or at least follow up and find out, well, what happened? Because I said this and actually the opposite happened. So I wrote on Twitter that the rap had been punked by Frank Luntz, because to me it was obvious that he wanted to gain clients in liberal Hollywood, and he couldn't do that as the Frank Luntz of old. So he just scammed her and said, I'm not doing politics anymore, so that the liberals in Hollywood might accept him, right? So I wrote on Twitter, you know, you really should follow up on this. And the rap is on Twitter. They have like 3,000 people. And the rap completely ignores me. I write another post. They ignore me again. So I use their tip form. I go to their site. I use their tip form and I say, hey, this is a tip. Your story was completely wrong. And I send them the links. And I said, you really should do something about this. And I finally hear from Sharon Waxman by email after I send in my tip. And she says basically that there's no story here and you're completely wrong. But she won't allow me to use her email and quote what she said. So this kind of annoyed me even more, because she's not only a one-way medium on Twitter, but she's doing this thing that journalists always do, which is they want to quote you, but they can't be quoted, right. You know. So I wrote a post at LA Observed, which is a very popular...
You just quoted her, by the way, didn't you?
Pardon me?
You just quoted her.
Told you what she said, but I didn't quote her. Those were not her words.
Yeah, yeah. Not that I would necessarily expect you to respect that. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
So I wrote this post at LA Observed, which is a Los Angeles news blog that a lot of journalists in LA read. And I recounted this whole story. And I said, you know, this really should be something that you note and correct. And she eventually did comment at my Tumblr, which is where I set up the comment thread for this story. And said, you know, I really find this exceedingly strange that you are taking such an interest in this story. And she remarked about how weird it was that I expected any sort of follow-up at all. And it's like two people looking at each other in mutual incomprehension. Because to me, it's incredibly strange that you tell your readers, Frank Luntz is quitting politics for Hollywood. Exactly the opposite happens, and you never say a word. But if you are part of an industry and speaking to insiders who do this sort of thing all the time, floating their names for jobs they're not going to get, you know, signaling that they're a candidate for this role when actually nobody's even talked to them, and when you're part of an industry press that kind of allows that to happen, you get so caught up in the way your industry works that you literally cannot see how it looks to outsiders. Because from my point of view, your story was wrong. It was proven so by events. You misinformed the people who follow you, as well as the entire web, because the item got picked up outside of Hollywood. And because you misinformed the world, you now have to say something. And to her, that's absolutely bizarre.
Right.
So I keep writing about it, and people say, you know, a few people criticize what I'm doing because I sort of keep coming back to it.
Right.
But I keep coming back to it because this is actually a very big divide between us and them.
Well, I got that too. I mean, that happens all the time, and it's more. I think we agree on what the phenomenon is, that the reporters get so entangled in the people that they're covering that they forget that there's anyone else watching this, and that their only interest really is in conveying information between, you know, very, very small number of people. That's all they're really thinking about. And that there are all these other people that are sort of eavesdropping in on the conversation. And
right.
That's almost incidental. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had the same thing happen, interestingly, with NYU Local this week. And I've been absolutely, I love the publication. I think NYU Local is incredible. I picked up a copy of the official NYU newspaper this morning. I had not read it, but I will now read it. But I love what NYU Local is doing. And I saw that they had a review of, I'm blanking on what it was a review of, but it was about the iPad. I wish I remembered. I think, let's just assume it was. And the reviewer said basically the reason why people don't get the iPad is because they're too old. And, you know, and he went on and on and on about people, you know, of my own generation and about how little we understood technology and how they, you know, well, we don't get things like that. And I was prepared when I saw the headline to link to it in a very positive way and say, here's, before I read it, because just seeing the headline, it sounded like, okay, this is, you know, this is a fresh perspective after we had just heard from the entire industry. Now we're going to hear what it sounds like to an NYU student who, you know, if you take the you know, container NYU student, to me, that I have a lot of respect for that idea, just the idea. But the closed-minded people of the future have to get their start somewhere at some point in time. And they have to start practicing earlier, else they won't be any good when they get to be older. And I read this thing and my chin dropped. It was just like, oh, my God, this is one cliche after another, you know. And so I just linked to it on Twitter and said, this is an example of ageism in a very sort of disappointed way. And what came back was very little in the way of pushback. Mostly people seem to agree. He got wind of the piece, that my criticism of it, and responded with, basically, I'm a net native. I'm entitled to be an asshole, basically, that kind of thing. And to which I say, no, you're not. You know, I mean, I'm a net native, too. I got equally sort of nasty. I said I was on the internet before you were a zygote. And, you know, that I am a net native. As much as anybody can be a net native in my generation, I am. You know, I started using the internet at age 18. That's pretty young, right? Not as young as some of these guys are, but it's still pretty young. And it certainly formed my character. And it's not fair to say that only, you know, that's why this net natives idea is such a bad idea. It sort of enforces this arrogance. But I said, you know, when I go to a foreign country, I get a lot of that too. You know, you don't know this place. Ha ha, he doesn't know how to get to the post office. Look at how cool we are, right? And I go, it's really silly to adopt that attitude because someday you're going to be a foreigner, if you're lucky. You're going to go out and have an adventure and you're going to go someplace where you're not comfortable. And wouldn't it be nice if people said, isn't it great this person's coming to enjoy our country, rather than say, oh, he's such a schlub, he doesn't understand how things work here, right? And the same thing's true of the internet. I mean, I love my mother. She has been using computers longer than all these kids have been alive, but she is not comfortable with it. And so there are some concepts. But through her eyes, she teaches me how crazy complicated this stuff is, because she just sees the components. She doesn't get the whole big picture, you know. And I think there's a ton of value in all of that. And so, you know, it's this insider thing that it's the elitism. I think these are the values that we share, is just really not having a whole lot of patience for that. But you have to watch out because it creeps into our lives too. It's there. I'm seeing it because I'm, you know, having a new experience now, a new city. And the last time I lived in New York was 1977. Okay. Give you a rough idea how long that's been. And, you know, It's weird. Changing things is very strange. So I think people who are changing and trying new ideas out, you know, support them. And I think that also there has to be, there will be a way for the behavior you're describing about this Frank Luntz guy and the woman who's covering him, that's going to get exploded soon enough. That
It struck me as very old medium.
Well, it sort of brings us around to the hypercamp thing.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
We've got about 15 minutes left. And I also want to do an inspiration of the week today. It won't take very long. The question came up. Let me just give a little bit of background on this. President Obama had a meetup with the Republican House, Republican members of the House of Representatives. And I watched it, and so did a lot of other people. And my God, it was breathtaking, refreshing. It was interesting.
Which led to a call for a new institution, Demand Question Time. Did you see that in that? Yeah, that was very interesting, too.
What was wonderful about it was Obama was saying the things that we always say to ourselves about, you know, how this politics stuff really works and how they're not telling the truth. And so he gets up there and does it with the one constituency he can get away with doing it to. You know, it really couldn't. They say you should do it with the Democrats, but he tried it. It doesn't work. He can't undermine the Democrats the way he did with the Republicans. But it's a wonderful thing. So this led David Weinberger, a Berkman fellow at Harvard University, a friend of both of ours, to ask the question, well, he observed that press conferences were, this was spelling the end of press conferences. This sort of signaled to him, this is over, no more, you know. And if we didn't know it was over before, this certainly, he's right. I mean, this absolutely does paint in pretty clear picture of why those things don't work. And so what follows it is what he asked. And I've had this design that was inspired by a couple of events, a couple of meetings that I was at where there were a lot of bloggers present, people I normally don't see. You know, I read their blogs all the time. Might even email with them from time to time, occasionally talk on the telephone, might have a cocktail, you know, stand next to them at a cocktail party, but that happens less frequently. For me, I don't like those things that much anymore, but never really had a chance to work with these people, you know? And so I think the answer to the question is that this hybrid of newsroom and press conference and open. Those three concepts put together.
Newsroom?
Newsroom, right? Press conference, open. You know? And so basically what you have is you have a big room, like a lot of the rooms that you guys have here, or I should say we have here at NYU, where it's just like sort of round table seating, and around the edges are computers that people can use, although people tend to bring their own laptops. I would also put refreshments, really good drinks and food and all the kind of stuff. And maybe more room, not maybe, definitely more room for standing up and schmoozing, okay? So widen the room a bit so that there's maybe at the core there's a table, some tables and chairs. Great connectivity, great networking, and open. And I know a lot of people would say, hearing this, oh, you can't have it be open. It has to be invite only, because if you make it open, the riffraff are going to come in, et cetera. Actually, I don't think it's going to turn out that way. I think that the number of people who have such an intense interest in a particular topic. Oh, you do it on industry by industry basis. So the entertainment industry would have one of these. The tech industry would. The biotech industry would have its own. The car industry would have one in Detroit, the government in Washington, D.C., or maybe many of them for each of the different lobbies.
There would be centers in the figures in the center, like a president, a CEO, industry leaders?
At the edges. I put the figures in the edges and I make them pay. In other words, that's where the money comes from for this. So it's not run by CBS, CNN. It's not even run by IBM and Microsoft, and the media industry has to have one as well, because they're making news all the time, but they're not covering themselves. But the bloggers want to cover them, so we will have one whether they want it or not. We'll have it there. And there also is an editor-in-chief for each one of these, so that open source and nonprofits get a chance to speak. There are podiums at either end of the room, right? And they're webcast the like I said, the networking coming out of this place is just phenomenal. And so every event, every paid for event and every free event is broadcast worldwide over the net. Everybody has access to it. And you only actually get up from your table or stop schmoozing to go actually attend the press event, which is happening just at the edge of the room that you're in, if you're interested. And my guess is, so that puts the onus on the person speaking to actually not just talk sound bites, because they have to compete with not only what's going on at the other end of the room, but they have to compete with what's going on in the world, because not only does information flow out of this room at an incredible pace, it also flows into the room. So it's the place where you go to work, the place where a news blogger goes to actually sit down and work. But the people sitting next to him are not employees of the same organization. They might not even be employees of anything.
Okay, so let's take, how would it work for, let's say, the iPad's release, if we had one of these events?
Sure. Well, the iPad's release is a sort of exceptional event. I mean, but let's see how it would apply. I mean, the problem with the iPad event is that there are truly a million people probably would like to go because they're so good at raising the press frenzy. So my guess is you wouldn't see iPad announcements level things there.
Okay, well, let's...
Smaller things. Think a little smaller.
All right.
Like Nokia comes out with their iPad competitor. That would fit into this model.
Okay.
So Nokia pays this organization $100,000 to buy maybe 4 hours worth of podium time. Spread over, I would, if I were them, spread it out over a couple of days. Not all in one shot. So that basically different shifts get a chance to look at it. You know, it's like you, I've seen you tweet things, you know, I do it myself a couple or three times because you know that there are people
checking
that are
in
Australia
times,
that aren't awake when you tweet it the first time, right? So same phenomenon goes on here. Remember, it's a worldwide thing. This is both physical and virtual in the sense that it's connecting up to the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get up and they have their product manager gets up and gives a boring presentation. But they learn that this didn't work. And next time they have instead, they do something different that's more attention grabbing. They get a chance to get a real understanding of how their ideas play with the people that they want to influence. Because, well, first of all, I'm not on their press list, right? Somehow, I never got onto it, right? But I would be at this event because, remember, it's open, right? They don't get to decide who comes to this or not. So now they've found another channel to access, but they really ought to be promoting their products to me, I think. You know, why? Because I'm going to tell people what I really think about it as opposed to, you know, what I think they want me to say to people about it. You see, this is how you ensure that you get undermined on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a system that put in the seeds of its own destruction, as soon as a savvy develops, right, knocks it down, that is a future, right? I mean, that's something.
I'm trying to imagine this. So we say to everybody who wants to understand this event or this puzzle or this problem or this new thing, come to our hypercamp, right?
Right.
And hang out for 2 or 3 days because you're going to learn a ton.
No, I wouldn't say you'd hang out for 2 or 3 days. You might come for one session.
Okay.
You might be there for 2 hours or something.
And we'll give you workspace. We'll guarantee you that there will be sources there, right?
Yeah.
Different kinds of sources there.
And food. Don't forget food.
And food and connectivity.
Right.
And an inflow of information.
And other bloggers, too.
Other bloggers,
to bounce
people writing
your ideas off of, right?
About this subject, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing will be wired so that it is both broadcast out and people can reach in.
That's right. You don't actually have to be there physically to be part of the event.
You can be part of it whether you're not there or not. And it's kind of like an intense focus, news-rich focus for a particular time in an open and fully networked way. And it's sort of like the media room at, let's say, the convention. Remember in 2004 in Boston where you had the media room where everybody's working? And it's sort of like a press conference, and it's sort of like a conference or unconference, right?
Yeah.
But the rules and the hierarchies are a little bit different, and it's made—
It's fluid.
It's fluid, right. And people are coming in and out, And those who have a message for the blogging and reporting community pay because it's worth their time to be present at such an event.
Yes. It's like buying advertising. They buy advertising, just like they buy advertising in other media. It's also the next generation conferences.
Right.
Because it's not it inverts things. One of the things we noticed going to tech industry conferences is, you know, everybody notices this. It's not a big secret, but all the interesting stuff's happening out in the hallway, right?
Mm-hmm.
So think of it this way. You just say, okay, let's just put a couple of speakers out in the hallway and put the food out in the hallway. Well, it's already there. You know, might as well throw some tables out there instead of them being everybody sitting in a desk facing forward, supposedly listening to this guy. By the way, they're not listening. They're all checking their email, right? Let's acknowledge that that's what they're doing and not even have them face the person, right?
Right.
That way we get a really good sense. Now, if all of a sudden everybody's over there, it's like I was walking up Bleecker Street yesterday and I happen to notice, like, you know, there's people going in and out of stores, but there's this one restaurant, just a huge crowd of people around, right? Man, that place must be hot, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they pay the people to stand there. You don't know. But the same thing would happen, right?
Well, that's what happens at open press, some big press events like debates, presidential debates, and also Davos is sort of like that. There's always things going on, and people go to where the action is, and yeah, it's sort of fluid like that. It's worth a sketch. I think you should sketch it out a little bit more.
I want to try it.
Yeah.
The times that I've come close to it, there had been two times. Once was at the O'Reilly Open Source Convention. I believe it was in 1999 in Monterey. It might have been 2000. It was one of those 2 years. And we were sitting there. Back in those days, people didn't always carry laptops with them. So they set up a room with a lot of computers for everybody to be on the web. And there was this wonderful sort of John Udell and Doc Searles and myself and a number of other people were all there in the same room. And we were collaborating in our blog posts. And, you know, we were dividing up that's the thing that really I'm looking for. I don't really, I want to hear what Nokia has to say, you know. And I would love to hear at the same time what their competitor has to say about them. Because, you know, they're going to be in there, too. It's like, you know, they're going to be in the room working the same people. So you'll get some really healthy, you know, differences of opinion, which is good. It makes a good story, right? But it's the collaboration that I miss. This is the new journalism model is very isolated. The individual doesn't have much contact with other people during. Now, I look at the newsrooms, you know, I don't know if they're so interesting anymore. Probably not, you know, because they're, you know, they're turning into ghost towns, basically. But I look back to the past and think, you know, man, those must have been really interesting places to work, right? Because
they were collegiality
to it.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. That's one reason why big news organizations are good things to have.
Right. So in the aftermath of the big news organizations, where are we getting that? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So seems to me this is a vital part. And it, you know, and so finally, when a guy like David Weinberger comes to the conclusion that this model is completely kaput, I think we're at an interesting point where maybe we should try it. We only have a minute left.
Mm-hmm.
So may I say the inspiration? The inspiration, depending on how you look at it, is either the New Orleans Saints or the city of New Orleans. I love the city of New Orleans more than I love the Saints. I never really rooted for them. I went to college there, and I've always felt an affinity to the city. And that the city, it's a sad story, the city of New Orleans, because I think in its genetics, the city knew that it was destined to be destroyed, basically.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it was in its destiny. There's no arguing that it was. It actually happened, right? But now that destiny having been achieved and now living in the aftermath, and now it's over. It's over because this is a city of champions now. And New Orleans is a city that's steeped in history and tradition. And
absolutely.
Also has a very self-deprecating sense of humor. They'll find something funny about this.
There's also a big tie between New Orleans and New York.
Is there?
Yeah. A lot of ways.
I want to hear more.
New Orleans could have been New York, you see, at the mouth of the Mississippi. Yeah. It could have been the commercial center of the country.
It was close to it. Second largest port in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. So New York emerged as the dominant port city because the Erie Canal.
The Erie Canal, DeWitt Clinton,
yeah,
right,
meant yeah. that it was the stopping point for goods coming out of the heartland and over to Europe. But New yeah. Orleans could have been that.
Could have been. But New York was a better choice.
Yes.
Just because of the environment and because of Katrina and what happened with Katrina. It was destiny. It had to happen. Everybody living in New Orleans knew it. It wasn't, they like to say after the fact, yeah, we weren't warned, but they were warned. They knew it was coming. But anyway,
here's
now
New Orleans
has something in its past. It's vindicated its awful destiny, and now it can see itself as champions. It's just wonderful. I just think it's sweet victory, and it's inspiring.
Dave, it's been a pleasure.
Absolutely, Jay. Thanks.
See you next week.